Hi, this is my happening and it freaks me out, Taylor.
And I'm hitting the man who I just cuckolded with my car, Jemmy. And this is the Final Girl Files. This week we watched 1970s Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, directed by Russ Mayer, starring Dolly Reed, Cynthia Mayers, Marsha McBroom, Phyllis Davis, John Lazar, Michael Blodgett, okay, and David Gurian. Yeah. Interesting movie.
One of my top four favorite movies of all time. You slightly less so.
I think, and I'll say this before we get into like stories, experiences with this movie. I think this may be the first time on the podcast where we have not a disagreement, but not the exact same opinion on a movie.
Yeah.
Which is, if you know us, we're like the same person. So that's significant.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun episode.
Mm-hmm. So, Taylor, what are your memories with this movie?
So, when I first was going on my, like, I'm becoming a movie person deep dive.
As we all do.
As we all do. One particular, and I am only slightly ashamed to say this because he turned out to be a shitty person, but the Cinema Snob basically, like, formed my taste in films as a young person. And, you know, whatever that is what it is. But he did a review of this movie, and I was like, this sounds fucking baller. I want to watch it now. And so I did. And it quickly rose up in the ranks. I've seen it so many freaking times. I love this movie. The vibes are exquisite. It's incredibly quotable. I think I've seen the original Valley of the Dolls, like, once. I know that one is also considered, like, a camp classic, but for some reason, it just doesn't scratch my brain the way that this movie does. Putting this movie on for me is, like, it's like a warm cup of tea. It's just like, yes, like, this is Taylor cinema.
For all that I have my own opinions on this movie, it is very you. Affectionate. Yeah.
It's Taylor cinema distilled into its purest form. Like, this and Creepshow, I think, are like the two sides of me, I would say.
The duality of man.
The duality of man. It's like schlocky 80s horror and like horror adjacent, like campy 60s, 70s, like girl band, like schlock, like sexploitation schlock. That's a tongue twister. Tried to say sexploitation schlock five times fast.
Sexploitation schlock. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, I love this movie. I will never get tired of watching it. I will watch it anytime, anywhere. It's great. Jemmy, this was your first time watching this, yes?
It was. Unfortunately, when I started watching this movie, it was during a period of time where my mental health was not great. And I have to wonder if that sort of painted my view of it. But yeah, I started watching this 2 weeks ago. Got overwhelmed with bad feelings and stopped. And it wasn't the fault of the movie. It was just like me and my shitty brain doing its shitty brain thing.
This movie was so bad that it did send you into a mental health crisis.
Yeah, it totally wasn't the fact that I had been isolating for 5 days because I got COVID.
No, for sure. No, absolutely not. It was this movie. That. This movie did that to you. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. Continue.
Absolutely. I could think this movie sending someone off psychotic.
Definitely,
feel.
Like, broken somebody's brain.
I mean that with
this,
all the
like this
in
was
my
definitely
heart.
The final straw in somebody's like mental health battle. They like checked themselves into a hospital immediately after finishing the film. The credits rolled and they like got up and they were like, absolutely. "I need to talk to somebody about what's going on."
Yeah, but yeah, I finished it between. Yesterday and today, because I realized I had been on vacation for this past week. I went to the lake and I realized, oh wait, I have a movie to watch for the podcast. So I put it on at 11 o'clock last night, got too tired before I could finish it because I'm old now and I can't stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning every day. And
that'll happen to
the rest
you.
Of it this morning. It will happen yeah. to you, especially with this movie.
This is a dizzying film. Do you have a, it like is. A plot summary or... something. I can attempt to summarize the plot.
Oh, that's right. I have to. I mean, the plot as it were.
The very basic premise of the film.
So, the plot as it is A starstruck all-girls band gets caught up in the pill-popping, sex-crazed night whirl of Hollywood in Russ Meyer's camp classic. And that does not even begin...
And it's like... Yeah, I guess.
Like, that...
Like, kinda.
That's what happens, but also... There's so much more.
It's so much more than that. It's so much more than that. So Russ Meyer had gained a lot of notoriety by this point by making movies throughout the 60s with one specific feature that he was incredibly well known for. Some would even say is his trademark as a director. Jemmy, I would love for you to guess what his trademark director thing is.
Tits?
Yes, just like women with huge tits. It was rumored that he had a, like, I don't know if this is true. It's probably hearsay.
Allegedly.
But it was rumored that he would not hire, like, an actress smaller than, like, a C cup. Like, would not do it.
Oh, man. There goes my opportunity.
Which is just so funny to me. Anyway. So, like, and if you watch his other movies, this is very evident. If you watch this movie, it is incredibly evident because there is not a woman in this movie who does not have massive tits.
It's true.
This film is wonderful. It was also written by Roger Ebert. And before you ask,
Roger,
yes,
I have so many questions.
That Roger Ebert.
I have so many questions for you. It's a shame you're dead because I just. Sir?
I want to interrogate him about this movie. So a little bit of backstory on the film before we go into, like, the actual discussion. Because the way that this movie got made is actually incredibly funny. So the movie Valley of the Dolls comes out. Very famous movie starring Sharon Tate. I don't know if it was, like, one of her first movies, but it was certainly, like, the thing that made her, like, a household name. And... So that movie gets made. It's based on a book by an author named Jacqueline Suzanne. And the 20th Century Fox was basically like, I mean, the critics didn't love this movie, but it did make a lot of money. It was one of those kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. So 20th Century Fox was like, why don't we fucking do a sequel? Like, sure, why not? So they brought on Jacqueline Suzanne again to write the sequel as she had written the screenplay for the first movie. And Jacqueline Suzanne actually came up with the title Beyond the Valley of the Dolls because she thought it would be... a good name for a sequel. She wrote a treatment in 1968. And then, like, they went through a bunch of screenwriters. A treatment was written by someone named Gene Holloway, who was then summarily fired. And then in 1969, Fox announced that the movie had changed hands entirely. That they had hired Russ Meyer to direct and Roger Ebert to write. Roger Ebert was actually writing for the Chicago Sun-Times at the time, and he took a 5-week leave of absence from his from his movie critic career to write this.
Oh my God.
Which is hilarious. And they basically cut Jacqueline Suzanne out of the project entirely, which is very funny. And Jacqueline Suzanne threatened legal action when they fired her from the movie. And it didn't go to court until after she had passed away a few years later. I think it was, like, settled out of court or something. It was not, like, a, you know, she didn't really get a lot of money. But her estate, rather, didn't get a lot of money out of it.
But right.
It went to court, it went to court in, like, 1973 after she had passed away. And the resulting film from this, like, absolute nightmare of a production is... what Russ Meyer pitched as simultaneously a satire, a serious melodrama, a rock musical, a comedy, a violent exploitation picture, a skin flick, and a moralistic expose of what the opening crawl would call the oft-times nightmarish world of show business. So basically, 20th Century Fox commissioned a sequel to Valley of the Dolls, and what they ended up getting was a satire slash parody of Valley of the Dolls. And that is this movie's backstory in a nutshell. It is intentionally insane. It's not accidentally insane the way that Valley of the Dolls is. It's completely on purpose, bonkers, what the fuck. And I love it.
G. Taylor, I wouldn't have been able to tell.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Valley of the Dolls is very ridiculous, and as far as I can tell, it's, like, meant to be taken seriously. So, you can never tell with these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But this is, of the themes and vibes of the first movie, like, pushed to infinity.
I've never actually seen Valley of the Dolls, so I don't have, like, a point of comparison there, but, holy shit.
I mean, again, you don't really need to, because this isn't a sequel. Right. So, the only thing you really need to know is that it's the same basic premise as this movie of, like, three women, they move to Hollywood, they get tangled up in all kinds of weird nonsense.
Right. I have a question.
Yes.
This is a 20th Century Fox film.
Correct.
Is this a Disney movie now?
I don't think so. I don't think it was part of the merger.
Oh, okay. It'd be funny if it was, though.
It would be very funny if it was. Honestly, it might be. I really don't know. None of the research that I did mentioned it being acquired by Disney, but it may have been. I'm not entirely sure. But no, I don't think it was part of the library that was acquired by Disney.
Again, it would be really funny if it was.
It would be very funny. It's kind of like how in the UK, Ravenous is on Disney Plus.
Oh my god, yeah. I love
that. I would love to see this on Disney Plus.
Every time I remember that, I get so happy. So,
I'm going to let you lead the conversation on this film, because I don't want to dominate the discussion. I want you to kind of lead the path. What were the things about this movie that stood out to you?
I mean, besides the everything of it?
Oh, you mean like every frame of the film?
Yeah, you mean like every single fucking thing that happened in it? So, before I get started, like, talking about specific things, I do just want to say, like, my opinion of this movie. So this is a shameful thing to admit as a film person, because I always get the impression that you're not supposed to be like this if you're into film. But I'm a bitch who generally enjoys movies that are, like, more traditionally structured. And I know that mm-hmm. makes me a terrible fucking, like, heathen who only likes the mainstream cinema, like, whatever the fuck.
No, it doesn't.
No.
Don't say that.
So, I found it difficult to get into this movie, and it's not that I dislike this movie. It's not that, like, it's not like a situation with, like, a Tarantino movie where, like, watching this was a deeply unpleasant experience that I don't wish to repeat. It's literally just not my vibe. It's just not my vibe, and that's okay. And, like, I don't hate this. I didn't hate this movie. I didn't dislike watching this movie. I just kind of didn't get super into it, but I appreciate it as a film with merit. I think there are things to like about it. It just wasn't my vibe, hence my somewhat low rating on Letterboxd. It wasn't super low. It was just sort of the rating that I give to movies, like, yeah, you know, I see where this is a film with merit, like I said, where it has, like, you know, things to talk about in it, and I see where it contributed to the art form, but it's just not for me.
Honestly, that's valid. I kind of knew that going in. I didn't expect you to be like, wow, new favorite movie alert. Because this is, again, like, I don't begrudge anyone even for disliking this movie. There's a lot to dislike in it. I just happen to overlook those things because I always have a ton of fun when I watch it. But I also, like, again, I'm very cognizant of the fact that it's such a specific niche of film, and it is so not for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And again, like, I didn't dislike this movie. I'm not sitting here saying, oh, I hate that I watched this movie. This movie actively made my life worse. Da, 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 da. It's just not for me. Just not for me. However,
which is valid. Like, again, like, there are plenty of movies that you can recognize the value of without them being something that you would personally go back to.
Mm-hmm. I will.
Everyone has subgenres and, sorry, I keep interrupting you, but everyone has subgenres and things that they enjoy over others.
Exactly. I will say, though, of all things, people who know me know that I don't really have the urge that a lot of people do when they find a weird little dude to, like, put him in a jar and shake him around and stuff. Like, that's just not my character type. However, I have never wanted to study any male character under a microscope more than fucking Z-Man. I am fascinated by this little freak. and I want to put him in a jar with a leaf and a twig, and I want to poke air holes in the lid, and I just want to watch him for a little while.
So, Ronnie Z-Man Barzell, would you like to explain this character? Can
anyone? He's just a little freak, and he talks like fucking Shakespeare, and he murders people with a sword at the end, and I am fascinated by him in every single scene that he's in.
He has stupid hair.
He has the stupidest 70s hair. First off, can I just say, hair and wardrobe in this fucking movie. God, I love the 70s.
I want every outfit. I want them all.
I love the 70s so much because it was truly a decade of fashion where people were like, whatever, man.
Here's the thing. A lot of people have said that the 2020s are going to be the new 70s, which I am inclined to agree with based on the political climate as of late. But that's not what I want to talk about on this podcast. What I want to talk about is that I want 70s fashion to come back in the 2020s in a big way. If we're going to go politically back to the 70s, I want us to start dressing like characters from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
If we go back to the 70s and I don't get to wear that like backless top from Texas Chainsaw, like what's the point?
Okay, before we move on and talk more about Z-Man, I am interested in what your favorite outfits from this movie were, because I have some, and I would like to hear yours.
I mean, the fucking Daphne Blake purple dress look was pretty good.
Yes, when she takes, what's his name, Porter, on that date?
Yeah.
To the little restaurant? Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a cute outfit.
It's such a like simple outfit, but there's just one like this, just like a red t-shirt and these insane bell-bottom jeans. It's like part of one of the music numbers, and I'm a little obsessed with it, and I don't know why, because it's just like a t-shirt and jeans, but also it's just so, the color scheme is so quintessentially 70s, and like the silhouette of like the tight shirt and the bell-bottoms, like I don't know why I'm obsessed and I want it.
Was it one of Harris's outfits?
No, it was one of Kelly's.
Oh, okay.
It's only,
I guess,
there.
It must have flashed by really quick in the montage because I can't think of it.
It did. It was a really quick thing, but like it just caught my eye for some reason, and I don't really know why. But what can you do?
It is a very cute outfit. All of them are very cute.
Unfortunately, I can't remember any other like super specific outfits. So please.
Okay, my number one outfit in this movie is actually, much like your t-shirt and bell-bottoms choice, is like a comparatively simple outfit compared to some of the crazy ones that this movie has going on. But I really like Pet's little outfit, her white dress that she wears on the picnic.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah.
When she gets up into the tree. Mm-hmm. I love that dress and I want it very badly. She's got this like kind of white mini dress with kind of like bell sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
She looks adorable in it, and just that combined with, like, the outdoor vibes of that scene, it's just great. And Marsha McBroom is gorgeous.
Oh,
so.
She's so beautiful.
She makes every outfit look good. Honestly, everyone in this movie is very good looking.
Yeah.
And also the outfit that Kelly wears to the first party, the one that she performs with Strawberry Alarm Clock in.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, sparkly kind of outfit. I also like the outfits that they wear to perform at the school dance.
Mm-hmm.
Those are cute. Those are my favorite outfits from the movie.
All very good choices.
I mean, also the Robin costume that Roxanne wears, I think. Oh, no, Casey wears it, right?
Oh, I don't remember. I do like her,
the
like...
The party.
I do like her, the, I think it's Casey that wears the long, like, black, gothic-looking sort of robe into that.
Yes, during the scene where she's talking to Harris.
Yeah, and, like, that stood out to me because I just remember watching the first scene of this movie and being like, this looks like a gothic romance cover set in suburbia. Like, something about the lighting.
Oh, for sure.
And just the way that the characters were dressed and sort of positioned in the frames, I was like, this is just, like, a gothic romance cover. All it needs is a scary house in the distance with a single light on.
Z-Man's pad is pretty scary.
It is. It's very...
Especially considering the ending of the film.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to talking about Z-Man. the best character from any movie ever.
Such a wonderful little freak.
Also, I'm just gonna say it. Trans icon.
Trans icon. Trans icon. Yeah, that was
I said that kind of flippantly, but I do also feel the need to state this movie is... Ugh, the way that it handles that is gross and not good, and I don't like it. However, I will paper over it by just saying repeatedly, Z-Man Barzell, trans mask icon. But yeah, I also will admit that as much as I love this movie, its handling of that is
not great.
Bad.
It's not great.
It's not great, and gee, Jemmy, would it shock you to find out that that decision was basically made on the day of filming that scene?
Wouldn't surprise me in the fucking slightest, Taylor.
It's not, like, in any way foreshadowed or, like, hinted at all before that scene. They just kind of decided, what if we did that? And then they did that.
And it was a terrible decision, and no one liked it.
It was bad. It was very bad. I don't like that scene. But, trans mask icon.
Yeah.
And he's just a little freak, and I love it for him. I do completely understand what you mean by saying that you want to put him in a jar and just, like, watch him.
I do. I want to study him under a microscope.
The way that he speaks is just... It's distinct in a way that I cannot quite articulate. It's just so bizarre.
He stepped out of a completely different movie into this one, I think.
Yeah. As evident by the fact that he single-handedly turned this, like, campy drama into a horror film in the last, like, half hour.
And he's a king for that. We love that.
And he is a king for that, and we have no choice but to stand.
We have no fucking choice but to stand.
This movie's also got lesbians in it.
This movie does have lesbians in it, and,
Love those lesbians.
Love those lesbians. Unfortunately, those lesbians are the only couple that don't make it out of the movie.
It is very sad. However, I do really enjoy the weird ending narration where the narrator at the ending is like, by the way, it's okay to be a lesbian.
It's okay to be gay.
It was so funny. I'm always so caught off guard by that line. I don't think that's the exact line, but he basically says, like...
If he was like, their relationship was not evil, but evil came from it.
Yes, he was like, yeah. It's so funny. It's like it's like they were writing that and they realized that it was kind of a bad look to kill off, to have the only couple that does not make it to the end be the lesbian couple. So they were like, and just throw in a line about how it's totally fine if you're gay.
It's
so funny.
I think that whole ending narration is so funny because it's like, hey, were you distracted by the literally everything fucking else in this movie that is going on? Here's all the lessons that the characters learned.
It's so good. It's even funnier because, like, reviewers at the time did not like this movie, which, like, I'm so shocked that nobody liked this movie.
Yes, very surprising.
Two, a lot of them called this movie, like, moralistic, and it's like, you have to know it's a joke,
yeah,
right?
This is a bit, right?
Didn't actually think that ending narration was serious, did you? Like, I was looking at, like, contemporary reviews for this movie, and a lot of them say, like, yeah, this movie was, like, so, like, moralistic, and it was, like, you know, perpetuating, like, these ideas of, like, you know, if you do drugs and rock and roll, you know, the narration tells you that, you know, all these bad things happened because they did evil, like, sex and drugs. But it's, like, it's jokes, guys.
It's a bit.
You realize it's a goof, right?
It's satire, guys. Do you know what that means? It means it's a fucking bit. It's a joke.
It's joke.
Jokes are in the room.
Jokes are in the room. Jokes are in every room of this movie.
Truly.
What would you say is, like, an underrated, insane moment from this movie? Like, obviously, the ending is bonkers. We all know that.
Of course.
What is another moment from this movie that you are like, wow, that was fucking weird. And, oh, we're just not going to touch on that again? Oh, okay. That's fine, I guess.
This is such a small thing, but, like, and I don't know why, we've seen this twice in, like, movies from the 70s, but, like, these people seem to think that women, or, you know, maybe this is just a bit, as I say, but, like, the women who just, like, go backstage and immediately strip naked, just completely butt-ass fucking, tits out, pussy out, like, naked, sitting there, completely butt-fucking naked, brushing their hair. Like, ma'am, you couldn't... Is that not uncomfortable? Like, you're sitting on this fucking chair, butt-ass fucking naked. Like, put some underwear on, at least. It's not even, like...
Yeah, she's, like, brushing her hair topless backstage. It's just, like, put a shirt on, girl.
It's not even, like, me being, like, oh my god, naked people. Ah, no, it's just, like, queen, isn't that uncomfortable?
This is such a movie written by men. It's so funny. And, like, part of it is that they were intentionally parodying movies like this, but part of it is also this was a movie written by men, and it's just, oh, it's so good. It's so horny. This is a relentlessly horny film.
I'm sorry, I'm flipping through my notes. I need to go back to Z-Man really quick, because my first note about him is simply, this man has about 4,000 red flags.
This man... His house is the red flag factory.
This man lives in Prince Prospero's fucking abbey from Mask of the Red Death. Like,
he's so insane. Tying these two things together. The thing that I was thinking about is the part where Z-Man is, like, taking Kelly on, like, a tour of his house at the party, which, like, okay. And, like, is this a thing that people do? Maybe. He, like, brings her into this, like, room, and there's just a couple fucking in the hot tub.
Oh my god, yeah.
And he's just like, anyway, let's just hang out here and watch them for a bit. It's really funny.
It's not even that. He's like, oh, come here and look at the plants that I have growing in here.
Yeah. He's just like, we're just gonna hang out here for a little while longer. Yeah, don't mind those two people fucking in the hot tub.
More highlights from my notes. Z-Man is what gay people are like. Goals, to be honest. I want to be this obnoxious about everything.
I feel like, yeah, like, being gay is just having, like, Z-Man Barzell as your, like, queer-coded villain role model.
Yeah, for sure. I have to say something cursed that's also in my notes, and it has nothing to do with this, but it's very cursed that I need to say it.
I'm very nervous about what you're gonna say, but go for it.
If the Les Mis fandom... existed as it is now in 1970. No. Harris would be someone's fucking fan cast for one of the Barricade Boys.
No.
Tell me you're wrong.
Why would you say something?
Tell me I'm wrong. He has big Barricade Twink energy.
Okay. Let's talk about Harris for a second, because his subplot is... Weird.
While we're talking about insane things through this movie, Harris...
Oh boy, I know what you're gonna bring up.
It's a miracle! My life as a paraplegic is done now because I, like, hit my legs in the right way.
It's so funny! Also, it's like, how do you see that and be like, yeah, this movie's just bad?
Yeah, this movie's taking itself super seriously.
This movie is taking itself so seriously. It literally, like, pitch-perfectly parodies all of those, like, sentimental, like, I can walk scenes from movies where a disabled person just is magically given the ability to walk again.
It's so funny.
I mean, to be fair, the way that he lost the use of his legs is because, I guess, in, like, a suicidal... In a suicidal state of mind, he, like, launches himself off of the, like, beams of the studio during one of the band's television performances.
It's all very Joseph Bouquet.
Something about that shot, I'm gonna ignore that sentence that you just said. Something about that shot, the shot of him just, like, like, without moving, just leaning off of the beam as the band is playing, and the way that the dummy, like, hits the ground, and, like, hits the drums on the way down. Oh, it's so funny!
I have to make another cursed... First of all, you can ignore that sentence now, but I know it's gonna haunt you tonight. Secondly...
No, it's not, because I'm ignoring it, and I'm not going to think about it.
Well, you can't ignore this. Cinematic parallels between this and the fucking Russell Crowe dummy getting lobbed off the bridge during the end of Les Mis 2012.
I'm leaving this conversation, actually. Okay. You can't hit me with 3 musical theater jokes in this less than 5 minutes and expect me to be fine with that, Jemmy.
All right, listeners, this is now going to become my 5-hour expose on WandaVision, so sit down and shut up and start taking notes.
I
thought you were leaving.
Like, everything about everything with him, he gets into this relationship with a porn star, but, like, I guess gets, like, bored and, like, is taking so many drugs that his dick don't work anymore. So she leaves him, and he sleeps with Casey, who is having her own, like, realizing I'm a lesbian arc over somewhere else in the corner.
Uh-huh.
And then he gets her pregnant. She is convinced by her girlfriend to have an abortion. He becomes suicidal and launches himself off of that beam. That's just one of many subplots in this film.
I really want to quickly actually, can we go back to insane moments in this film? Because I have a new favorite that I want to, and it's tied together with this, talking about Harris and the porn star, Ashley.
Is it the toe sucking?
It's the toe thing? Sucking thing. Like, yeah. The idea of chasing a woman off by being like, "Hey, I'm actually super into toe sucking," is so funny.
But she wants to fuck him so bad that she's like, "Yeah, I'll play along with that." It's really good.
My favorite part is when they're fucking on the beach and Harris doesn't want to because he's either like bored or he doesn't actually like, he's like never super into her is the thing. And then she goes off and like makes out with some, like she gets puffy and goes and makes out with some other guy in a bid to make him jealous. Like making the man who was never interested in me jealous by making out with someone else. Like, it's so
like he was the one who told you that he didn't want to have sex.
Yeah. Like, queen, what are you trying to accomplish here? Like, I understand if you just want to get laid, like, that's fine. But also,
her acting is so delightful.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's
See, she knows exactly the kind of movie she's in. I'm not sure the other actors did, but she does.
I literally wrote that down in my notes. I'm like, this actress knows exactly where she is and exactly what she wants to do.
She showed up to set. She's like, "I know I'm in a funny movie and I'm gonna fucking give it everything." I love that scene too when she, like, as she's walking away, they do this like wow wow wow, like this like music sting, this like jazzy music sting as she walks away from him. And also she basically like, she looks over at him and she's like, "Oh, you must be gay if you don't want to fuck me."
The confidence of it all.
Honestly, I want that level of confidence of like thinking that you're so hot that if someone doesn't want to fuck you, they must not be attracted to women. This movie features some me representation in Kelly's subplot, in that she fucks an old man.
That's true. That's very true. How does it feel to finally see yourself represented on screen, Taylor?
Oh, it feels great.
Finally, some representation for the people who want to fuck DILFs among us.
I love that scene of him like undressing and she's like on the bed kind of like, "Hurry up, hurry up," and he's got like 25 layers of clothes to get off. It's so good. I love this movie. Oh, Porter is so funny.
Oh my god,
he also knows the kind of movie he's in.
Oh, absolutely. That fucking bit at the end where he fucking turns the blinds on him.
Yes. Okay, actors in this movie who definitely knew that they were in a comedy. The guy playing Porter, Ashley, the porn star.
Oh, the guy.
Z-Man, for sure. For
absolutely sure. I think they might
be. I'm trying to think. I can't think of anyone else who was giving, like, an unambiguously comedic line read.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the stuff with Roxanne. But I don't know.
Roxanne did have shades of, oh fuck, what's her name from Sleepaway Camp, the aunt. Like, shades of that.
Oh!
What is her name?
Aunt Martha.
Aunt Martha. Shades, not completely, but like shades of it. I saw it.
No, she wasn't quite doing, "Of course, I packed a whole bag." But she, some of her line reads were inching kind of close to that. Mm-hmm. I also love that, like, they do this thing of, like, because obviously, like, it's the 70s, and, like, the only lesbian representation that exists is, like, predatory lesbian tropes. So they do this, like, bait and switch thing with Roxanne that cracks me up, where they, like, set her up as this, like, classic 60s, 70s, like, evil predatory lesbian. And then she's just, like, a normal person who just happens to act like a cartoon villain. It's so good.
That's just what gay people are like.
It's so funny that they just, like, pack all of these tropes into this character only for her to not do anything.
Oh my god, you know who else knows that they're in a comedy? Fucking Randy's actor. I think he knows.
Oh! When he was giving that monologue where he's like, the only thing that you can do is to live for today because you don't know if you're going to be able to see tomorrow. That was, he knew when he was dealing he with
knew.
That one.
He knew.
I love Randy so much.
I love that he just walks around shirtless for most of the movie. Like, yeah, King.
Delightful.
Yeah, King.
He's completely delightful.
I love that, like, Harris comes in, picks a fight, and Randy is immediately like, you gotta get him! Like, giving him an inspirational speech, like, while he's bleeding on the floor.
He's so good! I love Randy. Oh. Randy is so, so good. I love how, again, I love how cartoon villain he is.
Truly.
Where he's just like, anyway, got dumped, gonna, like, you know, not got dumped, got walked in on while cuckolding somebody. I'm gonna hit him with my fucking car on the way out.
Why not?
Why not? Just for shits and gigs. Oh, it's so good.
Can I say, when, at the party at the end with Z-Man, like, giving everyone, like, hyper drugs, I got fucking jump scared by, like, and I don't know if this is the name of the piece of music, but it's the same music that they use for the fucking Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia. I got jump scared. I was like, what the fuck?
I think it is just called the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Okay. I wasn't sure if that was just the name of, like, the short, the animated short, or, like, the actual.
No, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, audience, but I'm pretty sure that the piece of music in question is called the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Okay. I actually, yeah, when I first heard it,
it'll jump scare ya.
When I first heard it, I thought it was Pink Elephants from Dumbo.
It does sound like Pink Elephants.
It does.
And they kind of do, like, a Pink Elephants visuals.
It's very kind of very situation. Very Suspiria lighting.
Oh, for sure. Very I love Dumbo. That it just very quickly devolves into an orgy.
It's great. Like, of course it does. I will say about this movie, this is the kind of movie that only the 70s could have produced. This movie could not have been made in any other decade or at any other time. Only the 70s could have fucking produced this thing. And it actually kind of shocks me that it was made in 1970, because this feels very, like, mid-70s, you know? Like, I feel like it's like this movie was a sign of things to come.
Oh, for sure. This was, like, portentous of the rest of the decade.
Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's not my vibe, but it is delightful.
It is a delightful vibe, is the thing. Fun fact, Russ Meyer actually later said of this movie that he felt like he had pulled off the biggest caper in the world by making it and getting it, like, released under a major studio.
I love that.
He just, I love that his general sentiment towards this movie is like, I can't believe I got away with making that.
I respect the grift, Russ. I respect the grift.
I respect the grift. Also, fun fact, Pam Grier, a noted star of the 1970s, this is actually her first movie. She's an extra in the party scene.
Oh my god.
But she would go on to be in a lot of really fun 70s movies, like Coffee and, fuck, what's that?
I feel like I've heard her name before.
Scream, Blackula, Scream, which is the second Blackula movie, which I haven't seen, but I need to, because the first Blackula is very good, despite the title. Okay, so going back to what we were saying about, like, actors knowing what kind of movie they were in and not knowing, that was very much on purpose. So Roger Ebert later said that Russ Meyer, quote, directed his actors with a poker face, solemnly discussing the motivations behind each scene, Some of the actors asked me whether their dialogue was supposed to be humorous, but Meyer discussed it so seriously with them that they hesitated to risk offending him by voicing such a suggestion. So Russ Meyer purposely pretended that he wasn't making a comedy. Because he wanted the actors to play it straight.
I wish you could see my face right now. Russ, you fucking madman.
He honestly, absolutely fucking delightful. I found that out and something fucking clicked in my brain with regards to this movie. Just
literally nothing has ever like recontextualized a film for me so potently. Like, I understand now. I understand why it's like this.
Save for the few actors who clearly know the kind of movie that they're in, as far as the main cast knew, this was just a sequel to Valley of the Dolls. Like, they thought that they were making a movie that the director was taking seriously, and they were afraid to ask him if it was supposed to be a comedy because they didn't want to offend him.
I am obsessed.
That's one way to direct a movie, Russ.
It sure is. It sure fucking is. I'm obsessed. I'm fucking obsessed.
Oh, it's so good. None of the actors in this movie did their own singing.
I was wondering that.
Yeah, so the vocals for Kelly and I think Casey is the backup singer. And I think Pet also does some backup singing, but there are two singers listed as singing dubbed vocals for this movie. Lynn Carey, who was a soul singer who was based in Los Angeles, together with somebody whose name is Barbara Robinson. Barbara Robinson was the lead singer of a band, which is, I shit you not, this band is named The Peanut Butter Conspiracy.
I fucking love the 70s.
I
love the 70s so much. Can we bring back those too? Can we bring back like just batshit insane nonsensical band names too? Can we do that?
On a similar note, the band in this movie that is not the Carrie Nations, the band that is performing at the party when they first get there, is a real band named Strawberry Alarm Clock. And they were a very successful band in the 60s and 70s. And they performed their hit single, Incense and Peppermints, which I listened to that song a lot. It's not actually on the soundtrack, I think because the soundtrack people couldn't get the rights to it. But it's in the movie. It's a good song. Strawberry Alarm Clock is an insane name for a band. And so is The Peanut Butter Conspiracy. What's the conspiracy?
The conspiracy is that this fucking thing was definitely decided. The name for the fucking band was definitely decided while all of them were high as shit.
All of them so high. By the way, the amount of weed smoked in this movie.
It's a lot.
There's a lot of it.
There's a lot of weed.
The other thing about the weed in this movie is that every scene where the characters are smoking weed, they talk about weed in a way that no human being has ever spoken about anything, drugs or otherwise.
God,
like the dialogue in this movie is so clearly Roger Ebert, like a 30-year-old man at the time, who was so not keyed into hippie culture, trying to write a movie about a bunch of hippies, and it shows. And I understand that it was on purpose, but again, it did come out of this kind of genuine place where I also read this quote from him where he was like, I didn't know anything about this subculture. Like, it just wasn't the circles that I ran in. And I thought it would be funnier if I did no research and tried to write the dialogue anyway.
See, that's the approach that these studios who want to make, like, teen horror movies should take, in that, like, we don't know what we're talking about, so let's just go in, like, all in on not knowing what we're talking about and just make it completely absurd.
Yeah, the hippie dialogue in this movie, like, again, it's just slang terms that no human being has ever used. I think that we as a society also need to start calling weed, I think we need to start calling it grass again.
I agree.
Because I love when I watch a movie from the 70s and they're like, hey, pass me some of that grass, man. I don't know, I just think it's so much more fun than being like, you want to smoke weed together? Like, it's just cooler.
It feels a little more like classy, you know?
Yeah, it's a little classier. I think, listen, I'm starting this movement. Get with me on this, weed smokers of the world. We need to start calling it grass again.
All the weed smokers to listen to our podcast.
Weed smoking listeners.
These are my listeners, and yes, they do smoke weed.
This is a mess of an episode.
Oh, I mean, listen, considering the movie that we're talking about, I think it's fitting.
Yeah. You want to hear some contemporary reviews of this movie from people who just didn't get it?
Oh, God, Taylor, I would absolutely love to.
So, the first review that I found was from Roger Ebert's future TV co-host, Gene Siskel.
Oh my God.
So before Siskel and Ebert became a household name duo, Gene Siskel reviewed Beyond the Valley of the Dolls for the Chicago Tribune and wrote, having never worked with Roger Ebert before, that the film unfolds with all of the humor and excitement of a padded bra. Boredom aplenty is provided by a screenplay which for some reason has been turned over to a screenwriting neophyte.
Oh my God.
Your future co-host and bestie, Roger Ebert.
Do you think this was contentious in their relationship? Like, do you think this is a point of contention?
Because I know that they were very good friends later on in life, like in the 80s when they did at the movies together. So I really want to know if one day Roger Ebert just like cornered him and was like, hey, remember that review that you wrote? Remember the screenwriting neophyte who wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
That was me, bitch.
And now I've trapped you in a friendship. Get fucked. Honestly, there's no better way to start a friendship than scathingly reviewing your friend's screenplay in a newspaper.
True.
I just find it very funny that Gene Siskel really hated this movie. And then, of course, he and Roger Ebert would go on to become Siskel and Ebert TM.
It's very funny.
It is very good. Screenwriting neophyte. Oh, Gene Siskel also later put this movie on his list of the 20 worst films of 1970.
Oh my God.
I think it was at the end of that year. I don't think it was like later on he said that it was one of the worst movies of 1970, but right. It would be funny if it was, like if he made it in like 1993.
Oh my God.
And he was like, and it still sucks. Love you, buddy. You wrote a bad movie.
Oh God.
Another contemporary review comes from Charles Champlin, not Charles Chaplin, of the Los Angeles Times, who wrote that the movie was, quote, a treat for the emotionally retarded.
Oh, dear.
Sexually inadequate and dim-witted. It is a grievously sick melange of hyper-mammalian girls, obvious double entendres, and sadistic violence.
Oh, my God. Mammalian girls.
Just say they've got big boobs, just, you fucking pretentious asshole. Just say
big titties. Come on, man.
Just say big titted. Just say big titted girls. I just...
Sexually
inadequate and dim-witted. Also, casual R-slur drop. We love it.
Love that. Thank you, sir.
Oh my God. So funny. Gary Arnold of the Washington Post declared it a mess, a disaster, a stinkeroo, the most wretched of wretched movies.
I feel, you know what, actually at this point, like, there weren't as many movies as there are now that are just completely fucking horrible, so I guess I understand, but also, come on, man, there are so many other movies. You sure this is the worst one you've ever seen? Like, are you sure? Are you positive?
I'm adopting that as a, like, a term to talk about movies that I don't like. I'm gonna start calling them stinkeroos.
Stinkeroos.
I love I'm sorry, I cannot get over the term hyper-mammalian.
It's
you fucking pretentious piece of shit.
Just call it. God. Just fucking call them big tits.
Just say the women in this movie have huge boobs. Like, hyper-mammalian, fuck you, Charles Champlin. He's probably dead now, but fuck you.
They got tig old bitties.
They got tig, and you know what? They do got tig old bitties. Damn, Jemmy. You're so right.
We're a really serious film analysis podcast, right, Taylor?
Yeah. Aren't you guys so happy that you get to listen to us very seriously dissect films? Not movies, but films.
And it is a film.
Here's the thing. in order to make people take me seriously as a film critic, I think I just got to start using words like hypermammalian.
That's all you're going to do. That's all it fucking takes.
And maybe a newspaper will hire me to write movie reviews.
I haven't written anything like that since I was in college. Now I just make stupid little letterboxed reviews.
On the flip side, you know who loves this movie?
Who?
John Waters.
Huh.
John Waters has repeatedly cited this movie as being one of his favorite movies, if not his favorite movie of all time, and has, you know, called it one of the best movies ever made. I don't know if he's goofing, but I'm not, and I agree. It is one of the best movies ever made. This movie is in my Letterboxd top four.
Frankly, if nothing else, this is one of the movies ever. Like, full stop.
Honestly, here's the thing. This movie is packed with so much. Like, yes, this is a horror podcast, and it is gory at times. This movie is a horror movie. It's a romantic drama. It is an inspirational story of overcoming, I guess, being disabled. I don't know. An inspirational story of a disabled man who learns to walk again.
Yeah, man.
Oh, it's so good. The shot of his feet moving.
Oh my God.
It's so funny.
My toes. I could feel my toes. Oh my God. Was that a callback to the toe sucking?
Stop. I'm Taylor, rattling the bars of my cage
Taylor,
right now.
Was that a callback?
Harris starts the movie talking about sucking toes, and his last line in the movie is him getting really excited that he can feel his toes again.
What does it mean? What does it mean?
What does it mean? What does it all mean? Oh my God.
I hate this. This is the worst.
I don't. I love this.
This is the worst we've gotten since the Christmas Carol BDSM.
This movie brings it out in you.
It truly does. Like, if there was ever going to be, like, a movie that brought it out, like, it's this one.
It is so... This is a cursed film.
This is a cursed
and
film.
And a blessed film. And a blessed film.
It's a cursed film in the best way.
Yeah, it's a piece of cursed content. Oh! This is so random. I don't even know, like, a good segue to bring this up, but I do just want to mention...
We do segues on this podcast?
No, yeah, I forgot. We don't do those. The woman at the party who is, like, just randomly dressed like Catwoman with her nips out.
Oh my God, yeah!
She's a queen!
She is a queen.
I think she has, like, one line.
I don't even think she does. She's literally just walking around in the background with her, like, pantyhose catsuit, and it's like, yes, yes, queen, yes.
Yes, queen. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's got, like, this, like, Catwoman dominatrix thing going on. And also, I'm pretty sure she's got some of that, like... I mean, either she got, like, bad plastic surgery, or she's wearing those, like, face tapes that, like, yank up your face. Because her eyebrows were...
Oh, yeah. They were something.
Arched. They were arched. Something fierce. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about with regards to this movie? Because there's so much. I feel like we've talked for 10 years and also not at all.
Not specifically, I don't think. Just one of the movies ever.
I know we use that phrase a lot on this podcast, but on fucking God, this is the movie ever.
What other movies
it
have we said that
everything.
About? What other movies have we said that about? We said that about Crimson Peak. I think we definitely said it at least once about Multiverse of Madness. Suspiria, we definitely said that about. I think at this point we need to just start a letterbox list of, like, the movies ever.
The movies ever, yeah. If I ever care enough about my own voice to go back and listen to old episodes, I'll make a list of movies that we call the movie ever. But this I would say is the movie ever. It's everything.
It's so much all at once.
Just like Stefan from SNL, very like, this movie has everything.
And it truly
lesbians,
does.
Lesbians. Suicide attempts. a poorly handled transgender character who is simultaneously the best and worst character in the film.
A disabled man learning to walk again.
A disabled man who can feel his toes again.
Toe sucking. A porn toe star. Sucking.
A porn star, yes. Catwoman. And you know how
it's a musical.
Like sometimes, you know how sometimes he'll just be like Dan Cortez. I feel like that, but like with like Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you've listened to the entirety of this podcast and you haven't seen Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and you're saying to yourself, "This sounds like the best thing ever," please, please watch it. I need more people to understand how much this movie is, because it is so much.
And God, it really is. And I think that's all that that's my summary of this movie. It is. It is so much.
It is so much. Everything in this movie happens so much.
That's all I got.
That's all I got. Do you want to do some Letterboxd reviews?
I would love to.
Okay. A lot of people writing like long screeds about why this is actually bad, which I don't have time for. Sorry.
Who does?
We have fun on this podcast. Our first review comes from our first review comes from Hannah, who says, "Any female born after 1950 can't cook. All they know is start a band, smoke weed, cheat, be bisexual, eat hot chip, and lie." 5 stars.
Correct.
Will says, "Props to the late Roger Ebert for writing a movie that he himself would have written a slightly condescending 3-star review for."
That's so correct.
It's so real. Michael says, "Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is a cautionary tale for what happens when you hang out with a man who tries to talk like Shakespeare." 5 stars.
True. So fucking true.
Justin says, "Meyer's narration here will forever be more inspirational than any Hallmark card." 4.5 stars.
Yeah. God.
And those were the only funny ones I could find. The rest of them were just, like, long, long paragraphs. Ugh. And it's like, again,
We have fun here, sir.
We have fun. And I have fun. And I love to have fun. And this movie is so fun, which is why my star rating is 5 stars. All the way, always and forever. Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I love you. Blows a kiss to Roger Ebert from Beyond the Grave. Thank you for this. Thank you for this film.
And mine is still 3.5 stars. Again, not a movie I disliked. I had a good time. I had a good time with it, but it's not one that I would probably watch again if pressed, because it's just not my vibe, and that's okay. So, a solid 3.5 stars.
If this podcast teaches you anything, it's that you do not have to take you don't have to have a movie be your favorite movie to acknowledge that it has value and that it can be fun and that other people can enjoy it and that they're not stupid or something for enjoying it. Because I feel like that is a sentiment that is frequently lost in the age of online film discourse. Mm. Not to get up on my soapbox about this, but that is an opinion that I hold very dearly.
No, I agree. And like, listen, even movies that there are movies that I violently hate, like anything by Quentin Tarantino. But I can still.
This is the strongest point of contention in our friendship, by the way, because I am an unabashed Tarantino fan.
It is. This is the one place where Taylor and I like divulge completely as people.
Jemmy hates his movies.
I hate his movies so much, but I can take a step back from my hatred and be like, I see where this like influenced and improved the art form. And that's
and why someone else might like it.
Exactly. That's a thing. You learn this lesson really early on in film class, because if you're a film major and you're also like me and your taste is just in the fucking dumpster, you're like, I'm going to be watching a lot of movies that I don't necessarily enjoy as like a narrative or a, you know, film experience, but I can also take a step back and be like, yeah, I see where things that I enjoy in other films might have come from this, you know? Like, it's, I don't know.
just because you didn't like a movie or didn't, you know, not didn't like, but like just because you didn't, you know, you're not fawning over a movie doesn't mean you don't believe that it contributed something to the art form.
Exactly.
But also, if you dislike Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, you are objectively wrong.
Also, if it's that one and, like, Crimson Peak, if you dislike Crimson Peak, I'm sorry, I just recently rewatched Crimson Peak, and it only solidified the fact that if you don't like Crimson Peak, you are objectively wrong and probably going to hell.
Yeah. And that's all we have to say about that. What are we watching next time, Jemmy?
I labored long and hard trying to figure out what I could pair with this movie, because it's just so insane. And it came to me like a bolt from the blue. Listeners, next time we will be watching Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse. The only movie I can think of that, like, even begins to compare in terms of just, like, pure batshit insanity to this one in the modern day.
I've never seen The Lighthouse.
Oh, this is wonderful, because I've never seen this movie, and you've never... Oh my god, this is great. This is great.
Okay. Synchronicity, baby.
We love it. We love it. So, until then, you guys can follow us at FGFpod on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, even though... Have we posted anything on TikTok yet?
I'm planning on it. I'm trying to locate bits that I think would, but again, it's hard for me to go back and listen to episodes of the podcast to like pull bits to put on the TikTok, because I don't like the sound of my own voice, which like I probably shouldn't have a podcast if I don't like the sound of my own voice, but whatever. So once I gain the courage to go back and listen to some older episodes and pull funny bits, there will be content on the TikTok, but as of right now, it is empty, but you can preemptively follow it if you would like to.
And you can also give us those 5 stars on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, do whatever you need to do on your podcast platform of choice to let us know that you liked what we do here. And we will see you next time for The Lighthouse. Bye, guys.
Bye.